and welcome to another episode of Galbraith Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Finlay, and I'm delighted to be bringing you our latest Rural Matters discussion. We've got a bumper lineup today with representation from our rural management team. First off, partner at Galbraith based in our Morpeth office, David Hurst. David, welcome to what is your first podcast appearance.
Thank you very much, Matt. It's only been 15 months and we've got here.
I was going to say, we've been looking to get you on for a while, so it's really good to have you on.
Looking forward to it.
Joining his colleague across the border is consultant partner Tom Ward-Aldham. Tom, you're also making a long way to debut today, so it's great to have you on.
Yep, again, long time coming, but here we are.
And we've got a very special guest rounding off the panel today, Paul Cherry. Paul is a farmer in North Hertfordshire, and along with his family, runs the annual Grimeswell event, which is our main topic of conversation today. Paul, welcome to Galbraith Podcast, and we appreciate you taking your time out of the day to join us.
Thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, let's kick off our discussion. Paul, can you just tell the listeners a little bit about Grimeswell and how it came about and how it's grown over the years?
So, yes, I can. Grimeswell really came about because my brother John went off to a show in America back in about 2015. They run this thing called No Till on the Plains. It's a four-day conference in the middle of winter in Kansas, if you can imagine how cold it is. It's all indoors. And he came back from that thinking, well, really thinking two things. One was that we were struggling with a sort of the no-till concept at the time. We weren't struggling with the concept, we were struggling with how to actually do it. And the Americans were leading the charge, but we just felt it was a good moment to try and help a few European farmers actually get into the no-till as it was then. So we thought we'd just get lots of no-till drills actually running on the farm in real live sort of cover crop situations, and get some Americans over to come and teach us what was going on over there and how things were sort of shaping up with the no-till over there, because they've been doing it for 30 years and we're only beginners. So we did exactly that, and our accountant said we were mad, but we plugged on anyway and cleaned out a couple of barns and put a whole lot of chairs in it. And in 2016 launched our first Grimeswell. And to our astonishment, we really didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. But to our astonishment, people came from all over Europe, Scandinavia, and actually further afield. So we sort of established, we had 450 people in that first year. And that's what we realised, that we'd sort of taken a lid off something. There was a real hunger for knowledge, not just from farmers, but from the trade, to know how to do this sort of no-till farming. And it's really built since then. So that was 2016, and here we are in 24. It's grown every year, and we just try to put on a show that we would want to go to. I think we've all been to shows where you look at a lot of machinery that you probably can't afford. You kick a few tires, you see a few friends, and you come away realizing how little you can afford to buy. Grimeswell is very much about it's an ideas festival. You want to be have your brain blown really by new ideas. You can ask silly questions, get sort of industry experts there, but also you'll be amongst people who are all hopefully other farmers who are testing the water and at various stages of doing what they're doing. And so we're trying to create a really friendly atmosphere where you can just sort of ask those other farmers how to do it and what are they up to. You know, for us it's so exciting to see people sort of striking up conversations all day long, you know, with the person you're queuing for coffee, standing next to in the coffee queue, and find out that, you know, you've got tons in common and you can really chat about it. So that's really what Grimeswell is, I suppose.
How far down the route of no-till had you been before you decided you needed to go on explore into America and sort of bring some more ideas back?
Four or five years in, and our experience of it was that it wasn't just a case of sort of selling the plough and all the cultivators and buying a drill. It was, it started really well. And then gradually the weeds begin to get worse, maybe the ground slumping a bit, and it just seemed to get more complicated. And you have to be clever about, I don't know, cover crops and getting perhaps getting your timing right or getting the rotation right and all those sort of things. So we're about 4 or 5 years in, and that's when we realised that it just really wasn't that simple.
And what made you want to go down the no-till route in the first place? What was the driving? Were there a few driving factors behind that?
Yes, very much so. I mean, we farm a variety of soils from sort of chalk into clay down here in Hertfordshire, and we had a few sort of light bulb moments, if you like. Well, John in America, he saw the rainfall simulator, and that which we always exhibit at Groundswell. We brought it over from Kansas. And that shows you what a sort of 2 inches of rain can do to similar soils in different sorts of management. So, you know, he was seeing, we can show how much topsoil you lose in a sort of conventional farm situation when you get rain. You're losing soil down the drain, or, you know, you're getting runoff and all that sort of thing. So that was one trigger. And we had another big sort of trigger moment, which was we had one of those sort of flash 2 inches of rain in an hour rain events. This is about 12 years ago. And by chance, we were standing in a field getting very, very wet on not a particularly big slope on our farm, and looking across to our neighbour, who by chance had ploughed his land, and his land started, our land had sort of stayed put because it was double, and his land started forming rivulets and go back the next day, and there was a sort of football field of mud at the bottom of his field. And you think, this is really quite serious. You know, we're doing stuff to our soil that is completely unacceptable. I mean, there's enough wrong with farming anyway without you know, ruining our soil. So that was the sort of no-till trigger for us. We'd gone min-till, you know, we'd done ploughing, we'd done min-till, we'd done max-till, and thought, really, it is time to do something more serious. And so we said, right, okay, no-till is where we're going. Let's see if we can make it work.
But we had a large dump of rain yesterday. And looking around, very similar experience to that. But I have to say, I didn't come to the first couple of groundswells, I don't think. I don't know how I missed out. But anyway, ever present since. But the light bulb moment for me the first time was that rainfall simulator. And it just nailed a whole lot of stuff that I was aware of, but it just encapsulated it. And I thought that was quite extraordinary. And whoever invented it is an absolute genius. There's an extraordinary selection of people come to Groundswell, some of whom, as you say, in the queue for the coffee, you meet who you never meet in other lives, other people who you haven't seen for years, and so on. Can you encapsulate who the client? Well, they're not. Well, they are clientele because they're paying you, aren't they? But who they are? And does it get wider? And are there more farmers coming now, or how's it developing?
Yeah, it's interesting. Certainly, I mean, we're aiming at farmers because that's sort of what it's all about. But we get farmers, but they bring their families, or indeed, very often we get children bringing dad along, you know, saying, "Come on, dad, we've got it," or indeed, mum. The whole family tends to come, and we make it a fun event as well, so hopefully they want to be there. We want the trade to be there. I mean, we always have a big discussion about are we getting the wrong sort of trade there? Do we want, I don't know, the wrong sort of trade? I won't name and shame. But for me, it's maybe exposing the trade to how serious people are about regenerative agriculture, and hopefully they change the way they see farming as well. So if you're I don't know, a big tractor manufacturing, thinking that it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and heavier machines. We want them to see that, no, it isn't exactly, it's not that, for example. We get a lot of NGOs, we get a lot of students, we get a lot of politicians, which is exciting because I think that hopefully helps them steer the way they see agriculture going. And we even get a tiny bit of royalty. So, you know, it's everybody. And indeed, members of the public. We get interested members of the public who just come along because they're interested in how food's being produced and they may have views on, or they may want to learn about the sort of wider aspect of agriculture. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
See, you mentioned the politicians, and I'd say quite often the politicians are the least interesting people on the podium. but you know, looking at the way SFI and so on is developing at the moment, in my view, you've quite clearly influenced that train. But how are you finding those? You're looking at SFI and so on, presumably availing yourself of them. Are they actually managing to fit in with reality, do you think, or are they developing in that way?
Yes, I mean, obviously everyone has their views on SFI. I think it is, especially in an appalling farming year like the one we're sort of living through at the moment with a terrible wet autumn and indeed the wet spring, SFI does create a sort of plan B. So if you don't get all your drilling done, if you don't, you know, if you really are despairing of a field that used to be a field and is now a swamp, maybe you can turn to SFI or sort of shuffle your stewardship round. So that's I think that's how we see it. That's possibly a bit cynical, but as always with SFI, you've got to want to be doing it. You shouldn't be just be doing it for the money. You've got to be in a bit more than that. So.
But there seems to be quite an educational string to it. And you've got to do soil tests, you've got to do IPM, you're incentivized to do them. Some people may not have done them, and it's they're trying to open people's eyes to all sorts of things. But I mean, would you agree? I mean, I think that there's a massive wall of ex-BPS money at the moment, and money seems to be easy to get hold of. Would you be of the view that that's not going to sustain? We're all going to have to stand on our own feet in 4 or 5 years' time, or maybe sooner.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of farmers who are more, well, certainly south of the border, who are, you know, mourning the loss of BPS and who are not going to be able to make it up with environmental money. So and this is obviously the, you know, why financially it's such a tough time at the moment. And I have to say, looking around, I wonder how on earth some people are going to sustain, you know, look at the future at all.
Do you think, Paul, if we ignore the subsidy and the help from government, do you think that no-till regen farming, you know, that sort of very large phrase that we all sort of slightly grimace at now, do you think there's financial benefits in that, in running a business? So you're lowering your fixed costs, you're lowering your variable costs, you're taking a more holistic approach to farming. Do you think that's going to be the way forward for lots of people?
I think possibly we've all been led by the nose a bit too much by the big corporates, and so certainly one of our messages, yes, just stop spending money try and get back in a sort of future-proof situation where, yeah, you're less vulnerable to the bank, or to these huge expenses that we've got used to. But because we've been obviously feather-bedded by the subsidy, it's been very easy to make those sort of decisions. It's quite hard for people to get off that particular treadmill. Of course, the problem is farmers hate being exposed to the potential of sort of lower yields, and I'm afraid regen is not the sort of golden bullet. Your yields are going to suffer, but maybe you just have to have look much more at the bottom line, not just at how amazing your farm looks and how you can tell everyone down the pub that you're growing 11 tonnes to the hectare, whatever it is. So you know, that's our sort of message, if you like. For some people, it's just a very bitter pill to swallow, but I suspect the way things are going, it's going to become an inevitability. Yeah.
But perhaps a bitter or harder pill to swallow of increasing overdrafts and higher interest rates and finance of machinery and agrochemicals, fertiliser, etc. Yeah. I'm seeing here we've got clients who are wanting to go down a low input route. And when you do the figures, they're telling me that the gross margin and the overall margin is as good, if not better, than a conventional system. And when you get through, and that's on a budget, and then when you get through to harvest and analyse the figures, it rings true. So we're putting in a first wheat after a 2-year grass clover lay, and we're using some chicken manure for the fertiliser, and then we're not applying any manufactured nitrogen. We might apply one fungicide, but the margin at the end is amazing, and the yield might be 20-25% less. It's got to be the way to go.
Yeah, that's really exciting to hear, and well done you. And that's
Paul. I mean, one of the big kind of confusions I think out there before people come to groundswell, I'm not sure after, is the kind of distinction between regenerative and organic. And I think I can't remember if it was you and Helen Brownin were on a podium last year or the year before, and in very simplistic terms, they're using horsepower and steel to get rid of weeds. You're using Roundup. Is that a fair characterization? I mean, you had so much in common. You're trying to achieve the same thing, but by very different means. Do you fall out with the organic lot?
Soil Association has a very strong presence at Groundswell. And we would love to be organic. We're just stuck with this sort of weed burden. And I think Roundup has its own political issues, but it's also not really working as well as it used to, so it's not the plough that we thought it was perhaps when we started, and we were very kind of dismissive of, well, of course, if you're ploughing, then you're ruining the soil, and the soil's the most important asset on the planet and all that sort of thing, so how can organic farmers look the world in the eye? It's not a war zone at all between organic and regenerative, partly because regenerative is such a loose term. If you're organic, obviously you've got to tick those boxes. You've got to be you're totally prescripted by the rules that you've got to abide by. Whereas regenerative, heavens, I mean, you can work on the five principles and be really they are only principles, for heaven's sake. So it's not as though it's nobody's sort of checking up on you. And indeed, this is part of the problem with regen, if you like, is that now some of the companies are using regen as a marketing tool. Ooh, our farmers are all regen. The public hasn't a clue what regen means, but it sort of feels good. And we know that probably a lot of it is greenwashing, because they may be adhering to one of the five principles and then calling themselves regen farmers. So we're in that sort of rather difficult stage at the moment, and we're almost to the extent that Groundswell is going to distance itself from being the regenerative farming show or festival, because I think regen is just getting a little bit blurred, and we just want people to come and be thinking farmers. Taking a view on the future in many shapes and forms, rather than saying, oh, I'm a regen farmer.
How would you go about distancing your... I hear that message, and I think you're absolutely right. I always chuckle at a certain potato advert that comes on television as regen. You think, how do you grow potatoes at that scale in a regen manner? But how would you distance yourself from the regen banner, for want of a better word. How would you actively go about that? Is that your advertising, your marketing?
Or? Yes, I think that's all we're talking about. Groundswell is hopefully a name that most people recognise now in our world, and we can just call it Groundswell rather than Groundswell the Ridge. You know, so it really is as simple as that.
The more I learn about carbon, the less I understand it. That actually we are signed up with somebody at the moment, which is fascinating, really fascinating. The only way I'm getting my head around it is I'm just replacing the word carbon with soil quality. So I think we're going to get paid on improving our soil structure, quality, organic matter, etc., etc. And I find that a much, much easier concept to get around. Do you think that's a sensible way of going about it?
I think it's absolutely perfect. And I feel as though carbon is, if you like, the scapegoat or the thing we're all talking about at the moment. I suspect in 10 years' time we may be talking slightly differently. And soil quality is such a fundamental good, so you're completely on the right track by talking about that rather than focusing on carbon, the one atom. It's so much more complicated than that. So,
but the SFI has started that, or has kickstarted a lot of people into thinking about that, whether it's their organic matter tests or their legume fallow layers improving soil quality as a soil conditioner, as well as a break crop for 2 years before you put your first wheat in or whatever it might be.
I think we're finding the problem with our legume fallows that we put in last autumn is they haven't established same way that the wheat didn't, so we have a problem. So, Paul, the part of the regen thing is having livestock in the rotation, and I know John is fascinating on the mob grazing and what have you. Some farmers, it's quite difficult to get back into livestock farming. No fences, no water, wrong area. Does the livestock thing? It's obviously a regenerative tool, but does it have you managed to make it contribute to the gross margin, as it were, as well?
Very much, almost rather better than the arable, because we spend very little on the cows. They're effectively organic. There's no fertilizer, there's no wormer, they only they're pasture fed, so they need silage and straw. No hard food. We don't buy any hard food.
Are they outside all year round, Paul?
No. We're on clay, so they have to come in. So we've got yards. We also have the dry cows are on a corral, which is just a well drained electric fence enclosure. And now here we are in East Anglia. We've got straw coming out of our ears, and we love creating dung. So. It's fantastic to have that great big sort of, and the dung literally builds, especially in a year like this, builds up and up and up, but you just keep on putting the electric fence up as well. So if you want a really cheap entry into creating a cyclic cow yard, then I can't recommend a corral highly enough. But in terms of getting back into livestock, certainly around here we're seeing a lot of sheep farmers are sort of taking advantage of the fact that there are cover crops to be grazed. And so if you don't want to bother with livestock yourself, there's normally somebody who will graze your land for you very cheaply. So you can sort of tick that livestock box relatively easily. Because I do understand to get into livestock, it's a whole different level of expertise and commitment, and it's all slightly terrifying. But I mean, and the cycler herd, I understand, is reducing, and so people are obviously getting out of it. But we like the cows, and it's not just for fun. They show a margin. Yeah, it's just a really nice beep. You know, we've got plans to use the Groundswell label, but that's for the future. And I'm afraid, we could talk a lot about marketing pasture-fed animals. So it's a mountain to climb, I'm afraid, but it's but we're not there yet. And I think the customer is very easily confused by another label. That's basically the problem, isn't it? So pasture-fed is another label, and supermarkets aren't exactly jumping at the opportunity of using it.
Do you have cows on the farm when you started down the no-till route, or did you bring cattle back onto the farm?
We've always had cows. Always been cows.
It sounds like you've changed your husbandry, but have you changed breed?
No, there's still a rather scruffy lot of basically beef short horns, but there's a bit of Angus, bit of this and bit of that. They are and various things we're doing, but one of them is getting away from. We've had really interesting results from sort of buying expensive pedigree bulls that have got to their 400 day weights by, hard feeding them, if you like, and they just don't seem to fit in with our rather sort of hardy, the sort of system that we're asking, which is basically that they're never going to see hard food. They're only going to eat grass and silage. And straw, and sometimes it really shows that we're trying to breed back to get our cattle to understand that system, and it's fascinating. So that's a great thing about a suckler herd. You can breed to what you want to what you want to produce. It takes a little while, but I think our cows sort of understand our system. Right? They toughen up. There are challenges, and I could talk a lot about that as well.
Do you simply use electric fencing, or have you actually re-fenced fields which presumably had fallen into, we're going back into the arable fields? Have you bothered to re-fence, or do you just use electric fences?
We have to fence. We're very suburban here, so we have to fence for paths and roads, and perimeters we do fence, and use a couple of strands of barb and all that stuff. But all the In big fields, you break up with galvanised wire to help the mob stocking system, if you like.
It's fascinating. And the emotive subject of machinery, one of my favourites. Have you managed to sell all of your tractors then and just keep one small thing in a forklift to tow your direct drill?
David, I'd love to be able to say yes. But we haven't.
Is there still a plough and a power attached in the back
shed? Yeah, but they have to dig it out of the ground because it's sitting there vertically at the moment.
The groundswell plough is the monument to ploughing. So we don't have a sneaky little plough hiding around the back. Sometimes I wish we did, I may say, David, when I'm sort of confronted with a few foot of weed. Our horsepower requirement is definitely on the way down. We there's so many things going on here that I suppose maybe we're too shy to really go down that route. We've got off the treadmill of getting more and more horsepower, put it that way.
What you save on the tractors, do you spend on a variety of very expensive, sophisticated drills?
Yes, well, I mean, the absurd thing about drills is how much they do cost, but I mean, they tend to be grant aided, and by God, they hold their value as well. So maybe you don't feel so bad about spending silly money on a drill.
You don't have a puddle on the field on any of your fields at the moment. It looks better than the neighbours.
Sort of, yes, definitely. We've got a lot of worms. Every year it feels in better and better condition. It's just it doesn't always perform like you feel a really healthy soil should perform. And we've tried various sort of, we've tried lifting some of the soils. That doesn't really make a lot of difference. I think maybe we've taken a long base fertiliser holiday, and I think we're experimenting with perhaps putting a bit more of that. Put some P&K back on the soil, even though our soil indices are showing that they're holding up okay. I think we need to top up and sort of perhaps feed our crops a little bit more. The way the land is coping with the wet weather, I think it's true. It's perhaps not as obvious as some of the American stories that you hear, where the regen farmer, you know, can sustain a flash flood of 10 inches and his neighbour still has puddles, you know, on his conventional farm 3 months later. You know.
I always wonder whether Gabe Brown pays his neighbour to farm consistently the way he does, because it's always there. Surely he must wake up one day, mustn't he? But
it's astonishing. Yeah, the whole world beating the path to Gabe's farm, and the neighbour has never even visited. So,
if you wanted to see some horrible soils, you should come to Northumberland right now, and it is just saturated. Yeah. And it never has been more obvious that we've got a problem with soil condition.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
I wonder, did you, if you look back at soil tests from 10 or 15 years ago, and you look at your organic matter levels, how much do you think they've increased? Because I always found that when I was farming, practically, it was a really hard thing to increase, no matter how much sort of muck and sewage sludge and whatever else you lathered on the land.
Absolutely right. You're completely right. We need to learn about soil organic matter and our expectations of it as well, I think. The Americans are very good at saying, we gained 2% in 5 years and all that thing. It simply doesn't work on whether they're testing their soils differently from us, but if you can gain 0.5% in a couple of years, you're doing really well. It's a slow job. You're absolutely right. So I think just keep the faith and be conscious that you really can screw those soil organic matters by doing too much to your soil. That's basically what we're doing. All we're doing with the sort of regen model is mimicking nature. In nature, soil is never really disturbed, so it has the opportunity to build up its resource of microbes and roots and fungus and bacteria and protozoa and all those things. So they'll help build your soil humus, but it's a slow old slog. But it's one that's got to be done. There have been enough deserts created in the last few millennia since the Byzantians were ploughing, the Romans, and we're still at it, and we simply cannot afford to keep on extracting from our soils like we have been. And if we don't do something about it, then we're all doomed. But I think most of our, the vast majority of our foods are grown on soil. So just sort of thinking it's going to be grown in sort of food towers is simply it's not real. That's why we're doing what we're doing, and it's exciting to have the technology and the opportunities to be able to do what we're doing.
On a similar theme, in terms of nitrogen applications, do you still apply your 240 kilos of N to winter wheat? Have you managed to drop that right back?
Yeah, we do. Well, we do really, because our expectations have dropped right back, and it's horses for courses, isn't it? But no, we're definitely not that. And this isn't just about saving money, it's about being realistic with what your crop can probably produce. Yeah,
and not just assume. And the same with, usually not organic, the same with agrochemicals as well, fungicides, herbicides.
Yeah. The conversation isn't so much as what are we going to spray. It's probably more like, are we going to spray? We haven't used insecticides for 10 years, and it's not the end of the world as we know it. That's probably the most important change to make. But certainly fungicides, it's really hands off. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you got rid of your slug burden as well, or is that in a bad year?
There are definitely slugs out there. It seems to be this new thing called cereal grain beetle or something. And there's a lot of headlands down here that are really suffering on all sorts of farms, conventional and no-till farms. I think maybe some of the places where we were blaming slugs are now that. We used to apply slug pellets almost almost as a matter of course, just the same as one always used to put insecticides on in the autumn, because there might be it might be a virus problem. So if you get off that treadmill, then it's definitely progress. So yeah, we used to buy slug pellet by the ton, and now we buy them by the bag, and hopefully don't. You know, there are many years when we don't spread at all, but this year we will be spreading.
It's definitely too wet up here at the moment for slugs or any other beetles. They need their armbands.
I mean, you know, and I would hope that a regenerative soil is full of beetles and bugs that are going to be eating those slugs' eggs, and so you don't get those hot spots that we used to get. But you have to just be a bit patient with the slugs as well as the insects, I think so.
So just going back to groundswell quickly, someone was saying this year, last year, whenever it was, that we all used to come to groundswell to wonder whether we should do it, and now there are more and more people coming saying, how do we do it? Would that be a fair characterisation of some farmers, do you think? Or?
Yes, very much. I think that's... Okay. I mean, if you think back even 5 years... How much things have changed. The farmer's perspective of everything that they do has changed. And so this is, it's now about the how, it really is, rather than the why.
And I've noticed, I mean, that sort of early days for a lot of South Africans, Australians, Americans, obviously COVID kept them at home, that you're more... sort of native-based speakers now? I mean, obviously there's some stars from abroad, but
yes.
there's the talent at home to get on the podium now.
Yeah, well, the subject matter's become much wider as well, but yes. There's obviously some great American speakers, but they kind of speak a different language. They start talking about warm season crops and cool season crops, but the basic message is strong. And they do it really well, but we want our audience basically want to hear what's going on over here.
And the other interesting angle, which you'd appreciate from my end, is the connection with food. I mean, it's food is a much bigger market, and obviously we're feeding into it. But how do you keep the balance between? I mean, it's fascinating where food comes from, but do you have to watch your step on that? You don't get overwhelmed with celebrity chefs.
Yes, in a word. We haven't really gone down that route. We like our foodie, our foodie audience. But I think it's very much so that they can see that something's happening and see where they can sort of build on it, rather than sort of, this is how you cook this amazing stuff. I mean, we go really high end at Groundswell with the food itself, and anybody who comes realises that it's not a, you know, that all the food stands are, we vet them very, very carefully so that they're producing the right sort of food, but also producing it really well. And so there's that vibe, if you like. And hopefully people enjoy that as well. But
And you have the same battle, presumably, stopping it becoming a pop festival too.
Quite. I couldn't possibly
a little light music in the evening is all we need.
The village is still recovering from Andy Cato's set on the Wednesday night, and it's great that everyone comes and they really want to have a great time, and the camping, the amount of people who camp and stay up late and talk a lot of nonsense and drink too much beer.
I think the fascinating thing is meeting some of the people who are actually camping for the first time in their lives. Yeah.
Quite.
From castle to tent, perhaps, on occasion. Yeah.
Quite. There is a glamping. There's a glamping option, and yes, of course, a lot of people come in their mobile homes as well. So but I think we're going to be swamped with campers this year, because everyone now realises that they did not want to miss out on the Wednesday night. So, yeah.
Do you have any more big or radical changes planned for the show, or you're happy with
it? Nah, it's growing. It's more the same.
It's got a good vibe. It feels good. So why change?
Exactly, yeah, that's it. You're quite right. Very yeah. kind of you. But yes, yeah.
Well, we're all coming anyway, that's for sure. When shall we book the tickets?
Tickets go on sale 22nd of April. And by then we'll have announced who the sort of headline acts are. So we're not strictly speaking like Glastonbury, where they just sell the tickets anyway.
You've not quite reached that status just yet.
Elton John's making a return appearance.
Exactly. We'll see. Hopefully everyone will come. We love it. It's the most exciting thing. Obviously, the two most exciting days of our year. It's slightly terrifying, but it's great fun, and the vibe is fantastic. I find it incredibly moving that people are prepared to, especially the distances people come, not just in the UK, but I mean from abroad. People really do trust us to put on a good show, so it's a big responsibility, but it's as long as it works, it's unbelievably exciting. It's also fun spearheading the charge on this new style of farming, or the new style of thinking, if you like. Long may it continue, really.
Excellent. Mm. I think that's probably quite a good way to conclude, if I'm honest. And at this point of the podcast, Paul, I normally ask my guests to plug anything, but you've just done that for me, so that's absolutely perfect.
he's an old hand, yeah. Matt. He's been yeah. doing it for a few years now.
My panel teed him up well there, which is good to hear. Well, that's just about all we've got time for on today's episode. A thanks, of course, to my esteemed panel for another excellent discussion on the rural industry. David and Tom, like I said at the start, we've been trying to get you on for a good while now, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Matt. Really enjoyed doing that.
And thank you, of course, to Paul. It's been great learning about your journey through Groundswell, right through, obviously, some of the farming and agricultural stuff. And obviously, tickets are out in the next couple of weeks, so keep an eye out for that. If you've enjoyed today's discussion, please make sure to subscribe to Galbraith Podcast on Spotify or Apple so you never miss an episode. Leave a review or just say hi. We're always looking to grow, so please tell a friend about us, and please listen back to previous episodes of the show. There's been a whole host of excellent discussions involving Galbraith experts and external guests across all our business streams, so make sure to follow us, of course, on social media at Galbraith Group as well. Thank you for listening. I've been Matt Finlay, and this has been Galbraith Podcasts.